Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I believe that a bird should be beautiful, but it should be useful as well. So if egg laying is what they're egg layers, it's important for them to have that quality.
Jana Wilson is talking about her Sicilian buttercups. Her bird's beauty does matter when she's entering them in poultry shows. We'll take you inside the wild world of chicken beauty contests. Chef Arlen Llewellyn makes some chipotle eggplant tacos and describes her favorite way to stack the eggplant, cheese, and coleslaw into some hard taco shells. From Harvest Public Media today, before you have heirloom vegetables, you have to have heirloom seeds. We talked to some seed savers. And the ball jar. If you're doing any canning these days, you know it well. We learn about the history of the ubiquitous glass container. Checking in with Mark Chilla, here are the headlines.
U.S. agrotechnology and seed company Monsanto turned down a second buyout offer from Bayer AG this week, saying they're open to more talks with the German healthcare company, as well as other parties. Bayer offered Monsanto $62 billion in May to acquire the company. Monsanto officials called that offer inadequate, so the German company sweetened their offer to $64 billion. That's $125 a share, and threw in a $1.5 billion reverse antitrust breakup fee. But Bayer faced continued rejection after the Monsanto board unanimously agreed this week that the amount, the largest all-cash bid on record, still wasn't enough. Bayer said it was disappointed with the rejection, especially in light of Monsanto's, quote, recent weak business performance. And Bayer isn't wrong. Monsanto's income fell 37% in the last quarter. At the heart of the continued rejection is the issue of confidentiality and access to Monsanto's financial information. Bayer says it can't make a more financially appropriate offer without full access to that information. Bayer plans to continue to court Monsanto despite hesitation from some stakeholders who were still not convinced the transaction will create value. Converting some crops to perennial grasses could reduce the amount of chemicals flowing from farm fields into rivers and streams. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more on a new study.
Researchers used models to calculate how much of the flow of nitrogen into the Mississippi River's dead zone could be reduced if certain amounts of farmland grew switchgrass or miscanthus instead of their current crops. Iowa State University agronomist Andy Van Lucke says the results show that the grasses can help, but are not a silver bullet.
Perennial biofuels are an effective land use management. They're likely an effective land use management when it comes to trying to improve water quality, but they're not the only way to go.
Switchgrass or miscanthus could be used for feedstock for cellulosic ethanol, but currently the commercial markets for the grasses pale in comparison to those for corn or soybeans. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And the Colorado Department of Agriculture is killing pests dead without the aid of chemicals. In Palisade, Colorado, there's a research facility known as the Insectory, where scientists are developing biocontrol insects, insects adapted to attacking bugs and plants harmful to agriculture. Colorado's Insectory is the oldest and largest facility of its kind in the U.S. The pioneering program began in response to the Oriental fruit moth, a pest that devastated the local peach crop in the 1930s and 40s. Scientists saved the famed Palisade peach industry by successfully introducing a parasitic wasp that was the perfect predator to control the moth. Today, the facility is full of pesky insects and noxious weeds that have proven plagues to food and field in the U.S. over the years. The Insectory staff is busy studying the beneficial bugs that may eradicate these threats. It's serious research that can take a decade or two before confirming a potential biocontrol insect is sure to be on target in its attacks and not become a pest itself. According to the Insectory's manager, Dan Bean, the use of biocontrol insects is an important part of organic farming and an important way for farmers to reduce pesticide use. Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard are our news bloggers. You can read their stories on our website, eartheats.org.
Don't forget, we're on Twitter, too. That's the place to go to see what's happening in all corners of the food world, at Earth Eats. Mark Gilla, thanks for the work.
No problem.
Most vegetable seeds today are bred by seed companies to be hardy and easy to grow. They're created by crossbreeding different varieties and selecting for specific characteristics. Heirloom seeds are different. Like your grandmother's engagement ring, heirloom seeds have been passed down through generations. And today's gardeners likely wouldn't have access to many of their favorite heirloom plants if it weren't for the work of the Seed Savers Exchange. For Harvest Public Media, Sarah Bowden has the story.
Steve Carlson shows me around the grounds of the Seed Savers Exchange Heritage Farm in Decorah, Iowa. Every year, a fraction of the nonprofit's 20,000 heirloom varieties preserved in a state-of-the-art refrigerated vault are grown out to replenish the seed stock.
We have gardens all over the place, just little gardens. It's not 890 acres of just plowed land. This is like 890 acres of kind of rugged limestone bluffs and forests and valleys and pasture land, and then these gardens are sprinkled in all over the place.
The limestone bluffs provide natural barriers between gardens. That way, rows of dragon carrots, trail-tiered beans, and silver queen okra don't cross-pollinate. Seed Savers helped shape the heirloom community decades before these varieties became bistro delicacies.
We have like 6,000 heirloom tomatoes in our collection, so it's very likely that we have tomatoes in our collection that no one else does.
Before World War II, most produce grown and sold in the U.S. were heirlooms. Today, the majority of seeds are hybrids. Hybrids have a longer shelf life, but many of these strains can fall short in taste, texture, and appearance. Additionally, heirloom aficionados enjoy a connection to the past. As I munch on some Swiss chard, Carlson explains.
They are seeds with history, with stories, and they are related to specific recipes even.
It was a connection to the past that inspired Seed Savers founders Diane Ott Wheely and her former husband Kent Wheely. Diane and Kent weren't at Seed Savers the day I visited, but Carlson gave me a history of the company. As a wedding gift, the pair received seeds of German pink tomatoes and morning glory from Diane's grandfather. His parents carried the seeds with them when immigrating from Bavaria to Iowa.
Shortly after Diane got these seeds from her grandfather, he'd passed away, and so Diane and Kent felt this responsibility to ensure that these seed varieties that had been passed down in her family for multiple generations survived.
In 1975, the Wheelies started Seed Savers, trading seeds with about 30 gardeners. They believe the best way to preserve a plant variety is to grow it. Now heirlooms are back in style. Jay Miller, an editor at Better Homes and Gardens magazine, credits the foodie movement with heirlooms growing popularity.
They've suddenly become novelties again, and I think they're considered to be gourmet too. You find heirloom vegetables on a lot of restaurant menus that serve really high-end food.
Today, the Seed Savers Exchange has 13,000 members, reaching all 50 states and about two dozen countries. Some of the world's rarest fruits and vegetables bloom in Iowa. One Seed Savers member, Jerry Gettle of Mansfield, Missouri, joined in the 1990s.
I started trading seeds with people in Australia and Iraq, and from there, that really is what, you know, greatly influenced my interest.
In 98, Gettle started his own business, the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. He says his business continues to grow. In fact, the recent recession was a lucrative period for Baker Creek. Many people return to gardening to save on groceries and supplement their income.
The whole industry, you know, from Seed Savers to us to many of the other, you know, seed houses and even the people that don't sell heirlooms traditionally, all of a sudden they were scrambling to get enough seed of heirloom varieties just to keep them on their shelves.
Today, dozens of vendors sell heirlooms and millions of people eat them. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sarah Bowden.
The story originally aired in September 2014. See lots more from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Tis the season for food preservation. Cucumbers become pickles, tomatoes turn into sauce, watermelon rinds are candied. Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana explores the one thing that makes canning, pickling, and other methods of food preservation possible: the container. She speaks with Karen Vincent, director of collections for the Minnetristic Cultural Center in Muncie, Indiana, to learn about the history of the Ball Corporation.
Muncie, in east-central Indiana, is deeply associated with the legacy of the Ball family, for whom Ball State University is named.
The five Ball brothers founded the Ball Corporation in the late 1800s.
The Ball family is originally from, or moved to Muncie from Buffalo, New York. They started a manufacturing company in Buffalo in about 1880. They really did not intend originally to move from Buffalo, but just simply to build a branch factory. They came to the Midwest because of the natural gas boom in the late 1800s and visited several cities, came to Muncie, and the brothers were offered a very sweet deal by the leading businessmen in Muncie. By the late 1890s, they were all here, built their homes along the boulevard, and lived the rest of their lives all next door to each other.
Though the Ball Corporation is no longer centered in Muncie, it was a giant in the community and economy for over 100 years. Now it's a large part of local heritage, centered at the Minnetrista Cultural Center. Karen Vinson is the director of collections for Minnetrista, a museum home to a large archive of items of importance to the area, a number of which are food-related.
Muncie and Delaware County and the surrounding counties and the early part, late part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century were very much manufacturers of household products. So besides jars, and not just Ball, but a number of others, stoves, the Hoosier-style cabinets made in Elwood in Newcastle, Muncie pottery, Ontario Manufacturing in Muncie made silverware.
Among other items, Karen supervises 700 or 800 Ball jars and other jars made in the area, some of which are from companies Ball bought out.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country, and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball jar is, even if they've never canned.
Karen agreed to show me around the archives.
You know, I come from a long line of women who don't can, but for me it's the stories that go behind the jar that I think are the really interesting part. Several siblings, that probably in the 1930s, buried their pet canary in the Ball jar. And when they got back together one time at the family home when they were adults, sometime in the early 50s, they decided to dig it up, see if it was still there. So they dug it up. You could still see the canary, feathers and all. Well, they contacted George Ball and asked him if he'd be interested in having it, and he said yes. So they sent it to him, and we now have it.
Most of the items in the collection wouldn't go for much money on eBay or at auction. An exception are jars that have been modified to perform some new task.
This might have been a sugar dispenser. We have attachments that you would use to, as chicken feeders. I've seen them attached to oil cans. There's a historical society near here that has an iron lung from the TB epidemic that there's a Ball jar on it that is actually part of the mechanism.
It's clear from this that Ball's legacy in Muncie lives on. Minnetrista also facilitates food preservation in their community through educational workshops, where groups learn the history of home canning, practice the hot water method, and take home a jar of their finished product. I stopped by a pre-workshop cook session at Minnetrista, where educational staff were working on a test run of a champagne blush jelly.
It's a fairly easy recipe as far as ingredients go. It's sugar, champagne, and
raspberry juice.
Educator Ashley Lichtenbarger and Visitor Services Manager Tanya Brock ran me through the game plan.
We just combined the two juices. There's lemon juice and raspberry juice. And then you have to let that boil with the pectin, which is the gelling agent. And then you need to let it boil, and then you add in the sugar. And then you bring it to a boil and let it boil for about a minute, probably a little bit longer in this case. And then after that, then you add in your champagne, and then you put it in a processing water bath, which is the thing that makes it, preserves it, can, so that it seals the jars and all of that, and gets all the bacteria out and all that good stuff.
The champagne blush jelly might seem like an unusual choice, but it was picked for a reason.
In our canning workshops, we are trying to get people educated on a variety of levels. So whether that's the novice who's never even seen anyone can, learning the basics, or the person who's been canning for 70 years, getting them all at the same playing field of these are the modern scientific guidelines behind canning, And then we sprinkle in the history and the art. We try to highlight modern recipes, for example, like the champagne blush jelly, obviously a more modern recipe than mince meat, for example. So that is in response to trying to keep what we're doing very relevant, but with a nice nod to the traditional canning method.
Tanya, who's from Plainfield, Indiana, has been running canning workshops on and off since 1999 and has canned her whole life with periods of inactivity.
I can remember making grape jelly with Mom, and it was just part of what she did. And then when I started here, I don't know, 13 years ago, and I can remember my very first day calling my mom going, oh my goodness, I'm working for a place that has ball jars on display. Like, it was just everyday items, and I thought, really? As romantic as it sounds to say that I've been canning my whole life, obviously I wasn't cognizant of what I was doing. It was just, yeah, something that you did. But then bringing all that to fruition, working here and realizing that, yeah, this actually is a way that people have been surviving over time and providing for themselves.
Traditional Arts Indiana's second serving series focused on traditional foods. The story from Josephine McRobbie came out in 2011. Hear more at traditionalartsindiana.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Annie Corrigan here with you.
We are in the very tiny kitchen of Function Brewing, which is the pipe dream of my husband Steve and myself.
Arlen Llewellyn is the chef at this Bloomington brewery. Steve makes the beer. We've got a couple recipes with Arlen today. These are components for tacos, no meat tacos.
Just try to focus on whole foods that can feel really substantial and satisfying in a meatless entree.
Like eggplant that she bought from Raber's Family Farm.
Which you'll notice that I'm peeling because a lot of people are not too fond of eggplant because of the bitterness that that peel can bring. And I think when you remove that from the equation, you're just getting this meaty substance, but pretty neutral flavor. And this chipotle marinade will be bringing a lot of flavor to the party. So the eggplant's primary role is purely texture. So we are going to go ahead and cut these up into slices. You're almost done with that.
Then for the marinade, several cloves of garlic.
Red wine vinegar. Chili powder.
Some sugar and oregano.
Chipotles and adobo. Sorry, I'm going to turn this up. We're going to go ahead and put the eggplant slices in the marinade and just really let that marinade seep between the slices.
Best to let that sit in the fridge for a day or two. She had all the fixings ready to go that day, including some cilantro lime coleslaw.
Just going to load these up.
Starting with hard shells, then it's the grilled eggplant, followed by the slaw, and topped with some jack cheese. Now, Steve Llewellyn has a different philosophy on taco construction.
He would definitely say that the cheese belongs down here at the bottom, but I like getting that cheese last, so I'm going to put it on top.
Leave it to the beer guy.
Yeah, he thinks that it's because the meat, or in this case the eggplant, the heat of that will melt the cheese on the bottom. I totally agree with that, but I've just had so many tacos of my youth that started with cheese on the top that I feel very committed to that. These are going to be messy.
That could be like a tagline for the restaurant.
It's true, yeah.
This is going to be messy.
Maybe we should get Function branded bibs. I'll just say, these are going to be messy.
All of these recipes are online. Arlen Llewellyn's latest recipe for Earth Eats is spectacular, in a word. pickled deviled eggs that are a bright, bright pink, thanks to a bunch of shredded beets. It's at eartheats.org right now.
You've only got 3 competitors, tacos. From the Mississippi to the...
Chickens aren't a traditional pet, but with more of livestock being housed in urban and suburban backyards, some owners take just as much pride in their poultry as in their dogs and cats. So much so that they're primping and preening them for beauty contests. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon went to one in Colorado and filed this postcard.
So, real quickly, could I have you introduce yourself and say a little bit about where we are and what's happening today?
My name is Todd Simmons. I'm the director of Wolverine Farm Publishing. Today we're at our letterpress and public house in the River District of Fort Collins, and we're getting ready to kick off the prettiest chicken contest.
Prettiest chicken.
Yep, prettiest chicken. The chicken, urban chicken movement took off in Fort Collins 12 years ago, I think it was. Yeah, you hear people talk about the chickens just like they talk about any of their other pets. Yeah, and they're really excited about their different breeds and excited about their different personalities. So I think people have really been expanding their knowledge of the breeds they know, the Rhode Island Reds, the Leghorns, the Barred Rocks, and getting into some of the more exotic breeds.
What was her name?
Pasty. She's a lacy wide net Polish. That's what she is.
Yeah. She looks like a Phyllis Diller with red and black hair, and her feathers go out all crazy like on top of her head and cover her eyes. You can just see her beak.
What are you looking for as a judge?
I'm mostly looking for the way it looks.
I'm mostly looking for the prettiest chicken.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Well, first we have Mr. Leopold Simmons. So Leopold is showing off Dove. Come to the front, Leopold. So Dove is 10 weeks old. She's a Leghorn. If she wins Best in Show, what is she going to do with her fame and notoriety? World peace. Dove wants world peace. That makes sense, right?
You got
bored.
Okay. Oh, Boris.
Where's Boris? Say, Boris. Nice. Okay, moving along. Up next, Monica. I think it's Monica. Monica. Is it? Perfect 10. So, after all that, we come to one more award. The award that we all wanted, but only one can have. This year's, the first year's, Best in Show is Agnes. Yes, maybe I didn't say it right. It's Agnes!
What did you think?
What I think was great. This is the best way I've ever spent a Sunday afternoon.
Biggest takeaway?
Chickens can look very different. I had no idea. When I picture a chicken, I just picture a boring, you know, stereotypical chicken. But some of these chickens looked crazy in a good way.
Breaking down chicken stereotypes.
Yeah, I think that's what we all came here for.
So serious.
I mean, I don't know what I...
If there was ever a reason to visit the Earth Eats website, this story is it. The photos are so wonderful. See them at eartheats.org.
Say hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
I actually had one killed who was named after my great aunt. And so after Aunt Georgie got killed, we decided not to name anymore.
Maybe for the best.
Yeah.
That and Jana Wilson just has too many birds to name. Right now, it's 30 on her 20 acres of land outside Bloomington.
So here, come back, I'll show you.
She raises Sicilian buttercups to compete in chicken shows.
A chicken show is like a beauty show, and they have to have all the right beauty attributes. And there's nothing wrong with any of the other birds that don't make the cut, and they all go to lovely homes.
The Bible for showing chickens is the American Poultry Association's standard of perfection, which defines all the characteristics that make a breed unique.
Because I've chosen Sicilian buttercups, I have basically tried to memorize all these qualities. You know, you're looking for certain things, the way they hold their tail. You know, certain have to have a completely closed circular comb. See her earlobes?
Uh-huh.
They're white. Do you see the white? But those are her earlobes. In the buttercup, the standard of perfection says that they have to be white. So I've had some that have red earlobes, and those are ones that don't go onto the show ring. So.
You say you're breeding to get the best looking hens. What's that process like?
Well, it's all you have to experiment a lot. I mean, I'll take the birds that are the closest to the standard, and I will breed them together. But I use sometimes several different males, maybe three or four, and all of their offspring I put bands on, and I know what their lineage is. So I put together different combinations, and I make notes, and then you decide, okay, well, this pairing was successful, but this one wasn't. And so next year, you try it again, things like that.
This is an involved hobby.
Yeah, it is. Well, it doesn't have to be for everybody, but, you know, I've been raising chickens this is my 12th year. I believe that a bird should be beautiful, but it should be useful as well. So I don't breed birds just for beauty's sake alone. I mean, I want them to be useful. And so if egg laying is what they're egg layers, it's important for them to have that quality. So I look for that too. So there's more than just a perfect comb or perfect color, things like that.
Sicilian buttercups are on the watch list, according to the American Livestock Breed Conservancy. That means there are fewer than 2,500 birds in the U.S. and an estimated global population less than 10,000. Wilson says she's often one of few, or perhaps even the only exhibitor, to show Sicilian buttercups at some competitions.
What happens is I'll take these birds to a show, and I'll have sometimes an older gentleman will come up to me and say, I haven't seen one of those in 50 years. And people really get a kick out of seeing these birds that they may have seen pictures of them, but they've not ever seen them in real life. So I just think it's a matter of getting people interested in different breeds. And it's happening. I get emails. Oh, I probably get one or two a week at least from people who are looking for buttercups. They're interested in them.
These are beautiful birds, especially the chicks Jana raises. See pictures and get in touch with Jana Wilson if you like. We've posted lots of additional info at eartheats.org. Earth Eats is housed in the studios of WFIU Bloomington. Our team includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and all the reporters with Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. All right, thanks, guys. I'm Annie Corrigan.